Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, December 4th, 2021 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Suspect ruled incompetent. Judge in Boulder mass shooting case delays proceedings until man undergoes treatment. By Lee Schmelzer. COVID-19, vaccine or mask. Area businesses weigh which mandate to use. By Sam Tabachnik. Bond said it combined $1 million after Michigan parents enter pleas. By Corey Williams and Ed White. South Africa may offer a glimpse into the future. By Andrew Meldum, the Associated Press. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Suspect ruled incompetent. Judge in Boulder mass shooting case delays proceedings until man undergoes treatment. By Lee Schmelzer, The Denver Post. The Arvada man charged with opening fire in a Boulder King superstore and killing 10 people is not competent to stand trial and must complete mental health treatment before the criminal case against him can go forward, a judge ruled Friday. Ahmad Al-Aliwi Alisa, 22, will be transported to the state hospital in Pueblo for his treatment, Chief Judge Ingrid Bakke of the Boulder District Court ruled in a hearing Friday. The incompetency finding will delay progression in the case for at least 3 months. Alisa faces 115 criminal charges, including 10 counts of first-degree murder in connection with the March 22nd mass shooting, which left 9 shoppers and employees, as well as a responding police officer, dead. Neither the defendant nor law enforcement officials have publicly provided a motive for the shooting. District Attorney Michael Daugherty said Alisa's competency had backslid in recent months, but he is confident the defendant can be restored to competency with treatment and medication. The nature of the defendant's mental health issues was not discussed in the hearing Friday, although his attorney classified it as a serious mental illness. Bakke, on October 14th, ordered the suspect to undergo a second competency exam after the first exam found him not competent to proceed. The district attorney's office had requested the second exam. All 4 psychologists who examined the suspect over the course of the 2 exams found him incompetent to stand trial. In a competency exam, psychologists decide whether a defendant is mentally ill or developmentally disabled and whether those conditions keep the defendant from understanding the legal process. It's not about gauging a defendant's mental state at the time of the alleged crime. For a person to be found competent, the examiners must determine that the defendant rationally understands the proceedings and that defendants can assist their attorneys in the case. Prosecutors in the Boulder King Supers case previously wrote in court filings that psychologists found the defendant incapable of working with his attorneys. The case against the shooting suspect will be placed on hold until psychologists find the defendant competent, which can take months or years. The criminal case against Robert Deer, who admitted to killing 3 people and wounding 8 others at a Colorado Springs abortion clinic in 2015, has stalled for more than 5 years because of competency issues. Some defendants are found to be permanently incompetent. Officials at the state hospital in Pueblo will provide updates on the King Super shooting suspect's progress to the court every 30 days. Bakke next will review the defendant's status at a March 15th hearing. COVID-19, vaccine or mask? Area businesses weigh which mandate to use. By Sam Tabachnik, The Denver Post. Mike Tomasi and his business partners want to cater to everyone. So when Denver last week joined four other metro counties in mandating that businesses require employees and customers to wear masks or instead ask for proof of vaccination from all patrons, the Optimum Golf owners decided to do both. Their indoor golf facility in River North doesn't require masks, but anyone who enters must be vaccinated, and their Park Hill location is open to all, but they must wear masks inside. If we go one way, people will think one thing of us, Tomasi said. If we go the other way, we ostracize one side of our client base. As COVID-19 cases surged in Colorado through November and hospitals neared capacity, Denver and most of its surrounding counties lobbied for statewide action. Then, when that didn't come, coordinated on an indoor mask mandate, although they each gave businesses the ability to opt out by enacting vaccine requirements instead. For a host of Denver breweries and restaurants, the vax or mask decision was easy, but plenty of other businesses say checking vaccine cards is simply not possible without adding additional staffers, which can be hard to come by in a tight labor market. And without a sweeping vaccine mandate for businesses, everyone is still left to decide for themselves. What makes us tired is that it's always on the small business, said Justin Morse, owner of Brasserie Brixton, who opted to have his restaurant require proof of vaccination to dine. Because we didn't maybe do more stringent measures earlier, the government made the decision when we opened and closed. Now the culmination of these local decisions, these national decisions, is that my little restaurant has to be police officers of COVID-19 cards. It's frustrating. Choosing between mandates. Since Mayor Michael Hancock's announcement last week, 400 Denver businesses have pursued the option of becoming what the city is calling fully vaccinated facilities, according to the mayor's office. The numbers are lower so far in Jefferson, Adams, and Arapahoe counties, which implemented similar rules last week. 39 Jefferson County businesses are seeking the exemption from the mask order, local officials said, and 30 have submitted applications in Adams and Arapahoe counties. Boulder County was the first in the metro area to reinstate an indoor mask mandate in early September. Since then, 263 businesses in the county have been certified to verify patrons' vaccination status, according to Boulder County Public Health. To apply for such a mask exemption, businesses must submit plans to their local health departments explaining how they would verify that at least 95% of people in their buildings at any time are vaccinated. They also could opt for more limited exemptions. If, for instance, a gym wanted to allow only vaccinated people to attend an intense exercise class so they can go without masks. Denver has fielded 78 complaints since the mandate went into effect last week, mostly related to masks not being worn where required, a Department of Public Health and Environment spokesperson said. A host of Denver breweries and restaurants quickly decided after Hancock's announcements to do away with masks and go for proof of vaccination instead. Soon after the mayor's news conference, James Howatt, owner of Black Project Spontaneous and Wild Ales, went to get a drink at another bar. He didn't pass another soul as he walked to the bar with his mask on. But when he went to grab a seat, he took off his mask, as did his neighbors, not more than a couple feet away from him. I thought, what is this doing really? Howatt said. What is this doing to prevent hospitals from being overwhelmed? For bars and restaurants such as Black Project, Howatt thought, a vaccination requirement made far more sense. After posting the brewery's vaccine decision on Facebook, the owner said he got some people calling him a Nazi and telling him he's going out of business. But the post also was one of the most well-received he has had in months. I wish I didn't have to exclude people, he said. But if this mandate is about reducing hospitalizations, I couldn't do the mask thing and think I'm doing my part. With staffing issues rampant across the food service industry, Alona Botten felt that in addition to employee safety and comfort, her Trellis Wine Bar in Park Hill couldn't afford to lose anyone for a prolonged period if they got sick, another reason to opt for the vaccine requirement. We don't want to have to shut the doors because someone came in and wasn't vaccinated, Botten said. When Brasserie Brixton's Morse was deciding whether to go the same route, he looked at the numbers, seeing that about 90% of Denver adults had received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. We felt from a business case, there really wasn't much to lose by electing to check diners' vaccination status, he said, noting that his restaurant has a small dining room anyway. The business argument also led Tomasi and his partners at Optimum Golf to split their locations by mask and vaccine requirements, subscribing to a famous Michael Jordan line, "Republicans buy sneakers too." His theory was, stay out of it, you're a business, Tomasi said. We wanted to approach it from a business standpoint and not take sides and have people wonder where we stand. Not enough manpower. Other retailers said staffing issues made it impossible to check every person who walks through the door, something bars, breweries, and music venues are better equipped to do. Paul Epstein, owner of Twist and Shout Records on East Colfax Avenue, has been vigilant about pandemic safety since the beginning, closing his store before the city and state shut things down last year and mandating his employees get vaccinated. But on a typical weekend, his shop may get as many as 1,000 customers coming to peruse records. I don't have the manpower to check everyone's vaccination status, Epstein said, adding that it gets tricky when you're talking about whether to check for booster shots or minimum age requirements for each customer. He wished the government made it easier for business owners to implement these policies. It's too much for individual businesses to try and handle without the help of government, Epstein said. Kwame Spearman, CEO of the Tattered Cover bookstore chain, wanted to make sure his employees were vaccinated, but felt that it didn't make sense to put in a mandate for customers who came in for a short time to pick out books. Due to the nature of the type of customer coming and browsing and hopefully buying and exiting, we felt comfortable with the mask requirement, he said. Denver Post reporters John Aguilar and Joe Rubino contributed to this report. Bond said it combined $1 million after Michigan parents enter pleas by Corey Williams and Ed White. Pontiac, Michigan. A judge imposed a combined $1 million bond Saturday for the parents of the Michigan teen charged with killing four students at Oxford High School, hours after police said they were caught hiding in a Detroit commercial building. James and Jennifer Crumley entered not guilty pleas to each of the four involuntary manslaughter counts against them during a hearing held on Zoom. Judge Julie Nicholson assigned a bond of $500,000 apiece to each of the parents and placed other requirements such as GPS monitoring, agreeing with prosecutors that they posed a flight risk. Defense attorneys for the Crumleys said they never intended to flee and planned to turn themselves in on Saturday morning. They accused prosecutors of cherry-picking facts to publicly release and said their clients were terrified and only wanted time to make arrangements. Our clients are just as devastated as everyone else, attorney Shannon Smith said. But Oakland County prosecutor Karen McDonald said the couple took $4,000 out of an ATM not far from law enforcement or court locations they could have reported to, suggesting they could not be trusted to appear for future court hearings. These are not people we can be sure will return to court on their own, she said. McDonald's office filed involuntary manslaughter charges against the Crumbleys on Friday, accusing them of failing to intervene on the day of the tragedy, despite being confronted with a drawing and chilling message, "Blood Everywhere," that was found at the boy's desk. The Crumbleys committed egregious acts, from buying a gun on Black Friday and making it available to Ethan Crumbley, to resisting his removal from school when they were summoned a few hours before the shooting, Oakland County prosecutor Karen McDonald said. Authorities had been looking for the couple since Friday afternoon. Late Friday, U.S. Marshals announced a reward of up to $10,000 each for information leading to their arrests. The Crumbleys' attorney, Shannon Smith, said Friday that the pair had left town earlier in the week for their own safety and would be returning to Oxford to face charges. But Detroit Police Chief James E. White seemed to dismiss the possibility that was their intention. This isn't indicative of turning yourself in, hiding in a warehouse, White said. White said the couple were aided in getting into the building and that a person who helped them may also face charges. A Detroit business owner spotted a car tied to the Crumbleys in his parking lot late Friday, Oakland County Undersheriff Michael McCabe said in a statement. A woman seen near the vehicle ran away when the business owner called 911, McCabe said. The couple was later located and arrested by Detroit police. He added that the parents appeared to be distressed when they were captured. Head down, just very upset, he said of one of the parents. The couple was expected to be booked into the Oakland County Jail, McCabe said. On Friday, McDonald offered the most precise account so far of the events that led to the shooting at Oxford High School, roughly 30 miles north of Detroit. Ethan Crumbley, 15, emerged from a bathroom with a gun, shooting students in the hallway, investigators said. He's charged as an adult with murder, terrorism, and other crimes. Under Michigan law, the involuntary manslaughter charge filed against the parents can be pursued if authorities believe someone contributed to a situation where there was a high chance of harm or death. Parents in the U.S. are rarely charged in school shootings involving their children, even as most minors get guns from a parent or relative's house, according to experts. School officials became concerned about the younger Crumbley on Monday, a day before the shooting, when a teacher saw him searching for ammunition on his phone, McDonald said. Jennifer Crumbley was contacted and subsequently told her son in a text message, LOL, I'm not mad at you. You have to learn not to get caught, according to the prosecutor. On Tuesday, a teacher found a note on Ethan's desk and took a photo. It was a drawing of a gun pointing at the words, The thoughts won't stop. Help me, McDonald said. There was also a drawing of a bullet, she said, with words above it, blood everywhere. Between the gun and the bullet was a person who appeared to have been shot twice and is bleeding. He also wrote, My life is useless and the world is dead, according to the prosecutor. The school quickly had a meeting with Ethan and his parents, who were told to get him into counseling within 48 hours, McDonald said. The Crumbleys failed to ask their son about the gun or check his backpack and resisted the idea of their son leaving the school at that time, McDonald said. Instead, the teen returned to class and the shooting subsequently occurred. The notion that a parent could read these words and also know that their son had access to a deadly weapon that they gave him is unconscionable. It's criminal, the prosecutor said. Jennifer Crumbley texted her son after the shooting saying, Ethan, don't do it, McDonald said. James Crumbley called 911 to say that a gun was missing from their home and that Ethan might be the shooter. The gun had been kept in an unlocked drawer in the parents' bedroom, McDonald said. The Crumbleys' attorneys said Saturday that the weapon was kept locked but didn't provide more information during the couple's court appearance. Ethan accompanied his father for the gun purchase on November 26th and posted photos of the firearm on social media saying, Just got my new beauty today, McDonald said. Over the long Thanksgiving weekend, Jennifer Crumbley wrote on social media that it is a mom and son day testing out his new Christmas present, the prosecutor said. Asked in a news conference if the father could be charged for purchasing the gun for the son, McDonald said that would be the decision of federal authorities. In a video message to the community Thursday, the head of Oxford Community Schools said the high school looks like a war zone and won't be ready for weeks. Superintendent Tim Throne repeatedly complimented students and staff for how they responded to the violence. He also acknowledged the meeting of Crumbley, the parents and school officials. Throne offered no details, but summed it up by saying no discipline was warranted. McDonald was asked about the decision to keep Crumbley in school. Of course, he shouldn't have gone back to that classroom. I believe that is a universal position. I'm not going to chastise or attack, but yeah, she said. Asked if school officials may potentially be charged, McDonald said the investigation's ongoing. White reported from Detroit, Associated Press journalist Mike Householder in Detroit, and David Eggert in Lansing, Michigan also contributed to this report. South Africa may offer a glimpse into the future by Andrew Meldrum, the Associated Press. Johannesburg. Dr. Sithole Moyo was analyzing COVID-19 samples in his lab in Botswana last week when he noticed they looked startlingly different from others. Within days, the world was ablaze with the news that the coronavirus had a new variant of concern, one that appears to be driving a dramatic surge in South Africa and offering a glimpse of where the pandemic might be headed. New COVID-19 cases in South Africa have burgeoned from about 200 a day in mid-November to more than 16,000 on Friday. Omicron was detected over a week ago in the country's most populous province, Gauteng, and has since spread to all eight other provinces, Health Minister Joe Fala said. Even with the rapid increase, infections are still below the 25,000 new daily cases that South Africa reported in the previous surge in June and July. Little is known about the new variant, but the spike in South Africa suggests it might be more contagious, said Moyo, the scientist who may have been the first to identify the new variant. Although researchers in neighboring South Africa were close on his heels, Omicron has more than 50 mutations, and scientists have called it a big jump in the evolution of the virus. It's not clear if the variant causes more serious illness or can evade the protection of vaccines. Fala noted that only a small number of people who have been vaccinated have gotten sick, mostly with mild cases, while the vast majority of those who have been hospitalized were not vaccinated. But in a worrisome development, South African scientists reported that Omicron appears more likely than earlier variants to cause reinfections among people who have had a bout with COVID-19. Previous infection used to protect against Delta, and now with Omicron, it doesn't seem to be the case. One of the researchers, Anne von Gottberg of the University of Witwatersrand, said at a World Health Organization briefing Thursday. Although the study did not examine the protection offered by vaccination, von Gottberg said, we believe that vaccines will still, however, protect against severe disease. The findings, posted online Thursday, are preliminary and haven't undergone scientific review. South Africa's hospitals so far are coping with the surge, even those in Gauteng province, which accounts for more than 70% of all new infections, Fala said. The picture could change because most of those infected thus far have been younger people who generally do not get as sick as older patients. But Moyo expressed hope that vaccines would continue to work against the variant. I have a lot of hope from the data that we see that those vaccinated should be able to have a lot of protection, he said. That dovetails with what officials from the WHO in Asia said Friday. While warning that cases could rise quickly because of Omicron, Dr. Takeshi Kasai, WHO Regional Director for the Western Pacific, said the measures used against the Delta variant, which itself caused surges the world over, should remain at the core of the response. The positive news in all of this is that none of the information we have currently about Omicron suggests we need to change the directions of our response, Kasai said. That means continuing to push for higher vaccination rates, abiding by distancing guidelines, and wearing masks, among other measures, said WHO Regional Emergency Director Dr. Babatunde Olowokor. While more than three dozen countries worldwide have reported Omicron infections, the numbers so far are small outside of South Africa. That has led many countries to race to impose travel restrictions on visitors from Southern Africa, a move WHO officials said may buy some time, although the agency previously urged against the closing of borders. The travel restrictions have been severely criticized by South Africa, which says it is being punished for being transparent and moving so quickly to alert the world to Omicron. WHO said it was notified by the country November 24th about the new variant. While our scientists and those in Botswana were the first to discover and report on the variant, no one knows where it originated, Fala said. Colorado's second Omicron case found in Boulder County Traveler by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Boulder County Public Health reported Friday that a second Colorado resident who recently traveled abroad has tested positive for the new Omicron variant of COVID-19. Much remains unknown about Omicron at this point, although preliminary data from South Africa suggests it may be harder for the immune system to identify, allowing it to more easily infect people who recovered from a different version of the virus that causes COVID-19. That information still needs to be confirmed, though, and scientists are still trying to understand if the new variant is more contagious or causes different symptoms. Scientists believe that the precautions that work against other variants, including getting vaccinated and wearing masks in public, still offer protection against Omicron, although it's possible some could be less effective than in the past. Boulder County Public Health said a local health care provider had contacted the agency after a patient who recently returned from South Africa tested positive for COVID-19. The patient is in isolation, and the local health department is working with the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment to contact people who could have been exposed. Health officials didn't release any additional information about the traveler, including whether the person had been vaccinated. The first case in Colorado, reported Thursday, was a vaccinated Arapaho County woman who recently returned from visiting countries in southern Africa. 9 other states and 40 countries have found cases of Omicron. Most are linked to travel, although some local transmission has happened in the United States and parts of Western Europe, as well as southern Africa. So far, there's no indication Omicron is widespread in Colorado. Boebert maintains lead in third. Lawmaker appears unlikely to face any repercussions for her recent comments, by Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. Despite a video surfacing this month of Republican U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert implying that Democratic U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar, a Muslim, might be a terrorist, the Western Slope firebrand maintains a strong lead over those looking to unseat her, political experts and campaign finance data indicate. After a contentious apology attempt with Omar, a second video, first reported by CNN, spread around social media of Boebert making almost the same remarks about her colleague at a different event. She also called Omar and Democratic U.S. Representative Rashida Tlaib, who is also a Muslim, black-hearted and evil. Unlike Colorado's newest and politically competitive 8th congressional district, the 3rd congressional district favors the Republican incumbent. Boebert boasts a 7-figure war chest, while the next best fundraiser has only a fraction of that cash on hand, campaign finance records show. The leading contender for the Democratic nomination, State Senator Kerry Donovan, dropped out of the race in November after congressional redistricting placed her outside of the district. Boebert appears unlikely to face any repercussions for her most recent comments, either from her own party, Democratic House leadership, or those giving money to her campaign, Seth Mascott, a political scientist with the University of Denver, said. Every day she says a bombastic thing and gets a headline for it, Mascott said. There are some donors that see that as a positive thing. They like that she's offending Democrats. Mascott said he's watching the National Democratic Party and organizations such as the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee to see if they will move more aggressively to back an existing challenger or find a new one. And a Republican primary challenger appears increasingly unlikely, according to Bob Jenkins, former GOP administrative chief for the 3rd Congressional District. Continued Republican support for Boebert indicates the electorate's shift away from former U.S. Representative Scott Tipton, whom Boebert defeated in the 2020 primary. Jenkins, who also served as leader of the Pitkin County Republican Party, described Tipton as humble, quiet, and effective, and said ultimately voters forgot about him. He said he wouldn't use the same adjectives to describe Boebert. There's nothing soft-spoken or humble about her, but what the heck, Jenkins said. Voters like someone who will wear their issues on their sleeve and wear them with intensity. Boebert's recent remarks, or spat with Omar, won't hurt her with voters in her district or donors across the country, Jenkins said. There's no such thing as bad publicity, Jenkins said. But people in Boebert's district do suffer, Donovan said, expressing regret that redistricting pushed her out of the race. She wears her hatred and her racism on her sleeve, Donovan said, and it's very sad that an individual like that is now the voice of the Western Slope in Colorado. Progressive Democratic Representative Jamal Bowman of New York did push Republican House leaders on Wednesday to remove Boebert from her committee assignments, The Hill reported. House GOP leadership stripped then U.S. Representative Steve King of Iowa from his committee assignments after he questioned when white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization became offensive language. Months later, King lost his seat to primary challenger Randy Fenstra. But at the moment, Boebert likely won't lose her committee assignments. And even if she did, Mascott said, it might not hurt her in the same way it hurt King. Increasingly, that's the kind of person that gets rewarded within the party, he said. It's simply about saying the most eye-popping thing that will offend Democrats. Neither representatives of the Colorado Republican Party nor House Minority Leader Representative Kevin McCarthy returned messages seeking comment. Challengers and cash on hand. The two top Democratic fundraisers competing for Boebert's seat are Deborah Burnett of Jackson County and Soledad Sol Sandoval of Pueblo, according to campaign finance reports filed with the Federal Election Commission. As of the end of September, Burnett had $55,712 on hand and Sandoval had $48,965. The next closest is State Representative Donald Valdez of Lajara, whose reports show he had $29,182. Only two other candidates, Colin Wilhelm and Colin Berger, broke into the five-figure territory by the end of September. Kelly Rose reported $2,036 on hand, and Root Rutledge reported $214. All of that cash combined amounts to about one-tenth of Boebert's $1.7 million on hand. Whoever wins the Democratic nomination likely will see an influx of money from local and national donors looking to unseat Boebert, Mesket said. But even so, they'll have a large divide to bridge. Red Rocks Amphitheater is the world's most attended music venue for 2021 by John Wentzel, The Denver Post. With COVID-19 ravaging live music for much of the past 2 years, it was gratifying to see full-capacity concerts return to outdoor venues this year, including Red Rocks Amphitheater, which led the way for Colorado back in the spring and early summer. Now, the historic venue has been named as the most attended concert venue in the world by Billboard as part of a year-end box score chart of top-grossing and best-attended venues. It's Red Rock's first time on the list, and it covers venues of any size anywhere in the world. A Red Rock season like this is a tribute to dedicated artists, promoters, staff, and fans, venue director Tad Bowman said in a press statement. Red Rocks is a special place, and every person who steps on stage, serves a drink, greets a customer, or buys a ticket owns a piece of this success. The distinction arrives on the venue's 80th anniversary, during a year when Red Rocks broke its own seasonal record by hosting 233 ticketed paid events, including 177 concerts, 20 yoga and fitness programs, and 36 movies in the Film on the Rock series, according to Billboard. The previous record for shows per season was 2019's 168 concerts, the magazine reported. In 2020, a handful of shows were staged for audiences of 175 people in 2020, including the instantly sold-out acoustic sets from Nathaniel Ratliff and modest Colorado Symphony performances. This year, the summer season began under the shadow of the pandemic with reduced capacities, seating charts promoting social distance, on-site COVID-19 vaccination stations, and uncertain fans and tours, Denver Arts and Venues officials said. It's been an absolute whirlwind and extremely gratifying, getting from a year that devastated so many in our industry to our own record-breaking season, said Ginger White, executive director of Denver Arts and Venues, the city agency that operates Red Rocks. We're proud to play a part in Denver's economic and cultural recovery by providing so many Colorado residents and visitors a place to gather for the joyous return of live music. Billboard's calculations included gross ticket revenues of more than $60 million for 134 concerts, but because of reporting date cutoffs and promoter policy, numbers come from the show promoter, not the venue, and do not account for expenses such as venue rental, labor, or payment to artists, the magazine said. This year's Red Rocks concert season officially started with Lotus on a snowy April 22nd and ended with Playboi Carti on November 19th, according to Arts and Venues. Highlights of the season included a record-setting six-night stand by electronic artist and producer Shu, the Dead & Company shows that grossed more than $2 million, the season's highest, the debut of comic Bill Burr, and Widespread Panic's 61st, 62nd, and 63rd sold-out shows, the most by any band at the venue. Film on the Rock's holiday drive-in series continues for the next 2 weekends at the venue. Weather. Winter Nears with a Whimper by Thomas Piepert and Brittany Peterson, The Associated Press. Denver's winter approaches with a whimper, and the parched mountains to the west aren't faring much better. The Mile High City has shattered its 87-year-old record for the latest measurable snowfall. The old record was set November 21, 1934, and the city is a little more than a week away from breaking an 1887 record of 235 consecutive days without snow. The scenario is playing out across much of the Rocky Mountains, as far north as Montana, and in the broader western United States, which is experiencing a mega drought that studies linked to human-caused climate change. It's only the second time since 1976 that Salt Lake City has gone snowless through November, and amid the unseasonably warm weather in Montana, a late-season wildland fire fueled by strong winds ripped through a tiny central Montana farming town this week. The warm and dry weather has drawn crowds to restaurant and bar patios in Denver, and the city's parks and trails have been bustling with people basking in the sunshine in shorts, short sleeves, and occasionally flip-flops. As enjoyable as the weather is, climate scientists and meteorologists are warning that prolonged drought could threaten the region's water supply and agriculture industry. It also could hurt tourism, which relies heavily on skiers, snowboarders, rafters, and anglers. Every day that goes by that we don't see precipitation show up and we see this year-to-year persistence of drought conditions, it just adds up to a deficit. And we continue to add to this deficit year after year, particularly in the Colorado River Basin, said Keith Musselman, a hydrologist at the University of Colorado. Derek Greenough moved to Colorado a few months ago and immediately bought a snowboard with the hope of soon hitting the slopes, but on Wednesday he was enjoying the warm weather in a city park. I'm from central New York, so I expected it to be somewhat like there, where they have about 5 feet of snow right now, said Greenough, 27, who was wearing a tank top and exercise shorts. Today I figured that on the first day of December it would be snowing, at least something, but here we are. It's a nice day. I don't think I'll be snowboarding anytime soon. Denver's high Wednesday hit 73 degrees Fahrenheit, tying the record set in 1973. The National Weather Service is predicting similar conditions over the weekend, with only a slight chance of snow early next week. Frank Cooper, a meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Boulder, said a La Nina weather pattern is pushing storm tracks farther north into the Pacific Northwest and Canada, allowing highs in the Denver area to reach into the 70s. Basically, we haven't had any systems really be able to get into the area to cool us off, he said, noting that the average high in Denver this time of year is 45 degrees. Musselman likens mountain snowpack to a natural reservoir that holds moisture during the winter months and releases it in the spring and summer when demand from trees, plants, animals, and humans is greater. That natural reservoir is being affected by climate change, and warming is reducing the amount of snow that's occurring in the mountains, he said. The lack of snow in northern Utah is a rarity, but the record for the latest snowfall, set twice on Christmas Day in 1939 and 1943, is likely to stand, with snow expected sometime late next week, National Weather Service meteorologist David Church said. The mountains near Salt Lake City that are home to several ski resorts had a good start to the season when a wet October that dropped rain in the valley made snow in the mountains, but that slowed in November. Several resorts, including Deer Valley in Park City and Powder Mountain and Snow Basin near Ogden, have delayed opening because of the weather. With most of Utah stuck in extreme drought, a wet winter is more important than just making sure skiers have good runs. We need a good winter for snowpack out here, so hopefully we can turn the corner as we head into December and January, Church said. The lack of snow has led to a mild inversion in the Salt Lake City area, a phenomenon in Utah's urban corridor caused by weather and geography when cold, stagnant air settles in the bowl-shaped mountain basins, trapping automotive and other emissions and creating a brown, murky haze. Storms break up those inversions. In western Wyoming, Jackson Hole Mountain Resort opened on Thanksgiving using man-made snow on a handful of low-elevation runs and in an area for children and other inexperienced skiers. Resort spokesman Eric Seymour said, "We're not sounding the alarm yet," and he is keeping his fingers crossed that snow forecast for this weekend will allow the upper mountain to open. With such a dearth of skiable terrain open at resorts across Colorado, Breckenridge is set to hold an annual festival downtown to honor Uller, the Norse god of snow and the patron saint of skiers. Lauren Swanson, a spokeswoman for Breckenridge's tourism office, described the four-day festival starting December 9th as a town-wide snow dance. "We're hopeful that our snow dances and all of our celebrations will inspire Uller to bless us with a big storm soon," she said. "I believe in it. I do think it works." Fourth teenager arrested in Hinckley High shooting by Kieran Nicholson, The Denver Post. A fourth teenage suspect, a 17-year-old male, has been arrested in connection to the parking lot shooting at Hinckley High School that sent three students to the hospital. Aurora police announced the most recent arrest Friday, saying that the 17-year-old is being held on investigation of attempted first-degree murder. The teenage suspect was not identified. Three other teen suspects, all 16, face multiple felony counts in the case and have been charged as adults. All three face four counts of attempted first-degree murder, among other charges. On November 19th, three students were shot. Two 17-year-old Hinckley students, a male and a female, and a 16-year-old APS Avenue student. A school security officer returned fire when the shooting started around noon, police said, and the officer applied a tourniquet to one of the wounded students. One of the three was taken by ambulance to a hospital. The other two were self-transported. The shooting stemmed from a fight in the school's parking lot. "Lies hindering vaccine efforts," governor says, by Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Governor Jared Polis on Friday lamented that misinformation and targeted lies are creating resistance to vaccine science and killing Coloradans. Polis was speaking to the Legislative Joint Budget Committee about state spending in the 2022-2023 fiscal year. He prefaced his budget proposal with a commentary on COVID-19. "Our hospitals are now filled largely with unvaccinated Coloradans, many of whom are victims of misinformation campaigns and targeted lies that are being spread about the life-saving vaccine," he said. "Unfortunately, it's that misinformation that's making these unprotected Coloradans fall victim and get very ill, and in some cases die from the virus, as well as making them into vessels for new mutations like Omicron. Not only does this misinformation pose a danger to our public health, but with every new mutation, the economy here and across the world is impacted. About 30% of Coloradans remain unvaccinated against COVID-19, according to state data. Now in its fifth wave of the virus, Colorado is reporting several thousand new cases each day. As of Thursday, the state reported having only 67 intensive care hospital beds and 399 general hospital beds available statewide. Polis and other officials have warned for weeks that hospital capacity could be exceeded here this month. About 82% of the Coloradans hospitalized with COVID-19 as of Thursday were unvaccinated, the state said. More than 9,500 Coloradans have died from the virus. Polis, who touts the benefits of vaccination in virtually every public appearance, has mostly refrained from venting about vaccine hesitancy or anti-vaccination campaigns, but he has let frustration slip on some occasions. "It's just like science solved this thing, but then people screwed up the solution," Polis said in August during a conversation with the creators of the TV show South Park. "I have no qualms if unvaccinated people have a death wish, but they're clogging our hospitals," he told reporters last month. Prior to the pandemic, the governor's stance on vaccine skepticism was a source of great frustration to his fellow Democrats and the state legislature, who in fact scuttled a 2019 bill to improve childhood vaccination rates because they couldn't agree to terms with Polis. Another version of that bill passed last year. Polis 2 years ago called himself pro-choice on vaccines, and in an interview with the Denver Post months before the vaccine became available, Polis twice declined to say whether he still identifies that way. Some who owed taxes got federal aid. 161 entities were paid $13.2 million by Zach Newman and Jeremy Yohoila, KUSA-TV. At least 161 Colorado companies and individuals who owed millions in back taxes still qualified for federal pandemic relief loans, a 9 Wants to Know investigation found. Essentially, they're benefiting from taxpayer money without contributing to the system, said Tim Stretton, director of the Congressional Oversight Initiative at the Project on Government Oversight. Nine Wants to Know analyzed data from the Small Business Administration and the Colorado Department of Revenue. The analysis found that at least 161 companies and individuals that were paid $13.2 million through the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, still owe more than $6.6 million in delinquent state taxes. These loans should not have been approved in the first place, Stretton said. These loans, like other COVID relief programs, were intended for companies that were in good financial standing before the pandemic because they were supposed to be helping these companies weather the pandemic. Stretton said the government could have been more careful about who got the money while moving quickly to help companies dealing with an economic crisis. Those seeking Economic Injury Disaster Loan EIDL money, another SBA program, had to provide tax information to get the loan, but PPP loans didn't have the same requirements. There were simple things that they could have put in place, especially as the programs were reauthorized and lessons were starting to be learned, Stretton said. Christopher Chavez, regional communications director for the Small Business Administration, said only EIDL applicants are checked for liens because it's a loan that isn't forgivable. PPP loans, on the other hand, are forgivable. He said PPP was designed to help all businesses survive the pandemic, regardless or if someone owed taxes. Owing federal taxes was not a disqualifier for PPP, Chavez wrote in an email. PPP was an emergency aid program to help all small businesses survive the pandemic. Chavez said in an email that business owners could get PPP money in the second round even if they defaulted on federal student loans. He wouldn't agree to go on camera to answer questions about Nine News' findings because there is nothing more I can add on the topic. A Nine Wants to Know analysis of SBA data shows 56% of the $15.1 billion distributed to Colorado companies has been forgiven. In other words, businesses don't need to worry about paying back $8.4 billion they received through PPP. There may be other people and businesses that owe delinquent taxes and receive PPP loans that were not documented. Nine Wants to Know conducted this analysis by merging PPP and Department of Revenue data. A reporter researched for the same names in both data sets with programming software. The Department of Revenue refused to provide additional information on any person or entity on its delinquent taxpayer list to give Nine News the opportunity to compare further similarities between the PPP filings and the Department of Revenue's data. Stacks and stacks of mushrooms grow in a dark complex in Alamosa. A parade of round fungi poke out of the dirt, waiting for their turn to be plucked and prepared. Colorado Mushroom Farm has sent its crops to restaurants around the state since the 1980s. Owner Bajit Nanda said the pandemic hit the business hard. Last year, due to COVID, all the restaurants were closed, he said. Then all of a sudden, overnight, your sale, 50 to 70%, became zero. Mushrooms went to waste because there was not enough demand to keep up with what was produced, Nanda said. You have to pick up the mushrooms and then throw them away because there's no sale, he said. On top of that, the business had two COVID-19 outbreaks in 2020 and 2021 that affected 33 workers, according to data from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. PPP loan data reviewed by Nine Wants to Know shows the company got two loans totaling more than $1.7 million in 2020. Without that, we wouldn't have been able to survive, Nanda said. The SBA data show the PPP funding saved 200 jobs at the farm, but Nine Wants to Know found Colorado Mushroom Farm LLC owes $519,756.93 in delinquent taxes as of October 2021, the most out of those that were both paid and are late on their taxes. This $1.2 million gap between owed taxes and payment is the largest gap identified by the analysis. Nanda said the farm is too important to the Alamosa economy to shut down. Regardless of taxes owed, the PPP funding was crucial. He said if employees were laid off, they eventually would have had to rely on unemployment benefits. If we hadn't got this money, What would have happened, Nanda said. The farm would have shut down and the government would have lost the money and the local economy would have suffered. Nanda said the company got behind on its taxes in part because it spent $5 million on specialized farming equipment in March 2020 and has not been able to use it. The pandemic prevented the manufacturer from traveling to Colorado from Netherlands to finish setting it up. According to Nanda, the farm's current equipment is 40 years old. So when the equipment breaks down, that delays all the operations, Nanda said. We really lost a lot of money during COVID. He said the goal was to grow 52 batches of crops a year. In 2020, Landa said they were able to only produce 20 batches. Even before the PPP money came in, Colorado Mushroom Farm had a pattern of problems. The IRS issued an $824,518.23 federal lien against Nanda in October 2020. The document shows Nanda did not pay enough taxes in 2017 and 2018. The farm was unable to produce as it should have produced, Nanda said. So during that period, yes, there were some taxes we didn't pay. But at the same time, our attorneys are working with the IRS to put a payment plan together so that we can pay those taxes. Stretton said these liens should have stopped the mushroom farm from getting relief funds. If these companies had tax liens and were not paying federal taxes, they probably weren't in good financial standing and probably shouldn't have been eligible for these loans, Stretton said. The company might be on the hook for even more money. Rockra Mushroom Farm Corporation owes Colorado taxpayers $1.8 million as of October. The two have the same ownership. Rockra Mushroom Farm Corporation is connected to Colorado Mushroom Farm on the company website. The businesses have the same address in the Secretary of State's records with the same registered agent, Colorado Mushroom Farm and Rockra. Nanda confirmed that both entities are operated by the same ownership. The tab keeps growing for the mushroom farm. The businesses now owe $2.4 million in back taxes, an increase of $158,522 from July to October of this year. Nanda said he will continue to grow mushrooms to keep his employees working. My obligation is to those employees, number one, he said. My obligation is to the local economy, and the company should pay their taxes. And that's where I'm focused on. And that's why I'm still here. I'm still working, even during COVID. 13 of the companies that received PPP funding and were delinquent on their taxes in July are no longer delinquent, according to an October analysis. This includes After Hours, an urgent care company that received $867,197 in federal PPP funding, the second highest payout among the companies that were paid and were delinquent on their taxes. Chris Rehm runs the five after-hours locations and said that a lot of the clinic's efforts have gone into treating and testing thousands of people for COVID-19. That PPP money meant they could stay open, he said. We wouldn't have made it through that period without that funding, Rehm said. The company has a history of problems paying its taxes. The IRS sent the company five liens in 2019 and 2020, totaling $688,986.69. Rehm said that despite this, the company should be eligible to get aid. What would be unfair? Rehm asked. That was very explicitly addressed, and we talked with the IRS representatives when we took out the loan. They were separate. We talked to legal counsel on it, so we worked our way through it. When 9 Wants to Know analyzed the July 2021 data, After Hours owed $1,418.51 in delinquent taxes. This was different from the federal liens it also owed. 9 Wants to Know first reached out to the company for an interview in early October. Sometime between July and October, After Hours paid off the $1,418.51 it owed in delinquent taxes. We certainly had our struggles, Rehm said, and this gives us the opportunity to survive in advance. Rehm added that his company is in compliance with the IRS and has been making payments on past tax debt. Without the COVID-19 relief, he said 65 healthcare employees wouldn't be working. Of the 148 companies and people that are still delinquent, the median amount owed was $30,396. 61 companies typically paid off $2,193 taxes since July. 66 companies added delinquent taxes to their tab, typically by $1,351. November jobs report sends mixed signals on economy. Labor Department data muddles plans of Fed policymakers. By Nelson D. Schwartz and Talman Joseph Smith, The New York Times. American employers reported weaker than expected hiring last month, but a survey of American workers showed a surge in the number taking jobs. Those conflicting pictures emerged from a single government report Friday, further clouding the economic outlook as a new phase of the pandemic unfolds. The ambiguous Labor Department data muddles the calculations of Federal Reserve policymakers, weighing whether to shift their focus from creating jobs to reining in prices. It is a complication for a White House trying to show the success of its economic course. Thank you for joining us for the reading of the Saturday, December 4th, 2021 Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane.
One of the major takeaways from last month's big climate conference in Scotland is all levels of government need to collaborate to address climate change. One small New York community is trying to do just that. Hastings-on-Hudson is 20 miles north of New York City, on the banks of the Hudson River. Due to more frequent extreme weather events, Mayor Nikki Armacost says flooding has become a repeat concern. So the town has adopted a climate emergency declaration, working with Westchester County to reduce greenhouse gases. Armacost says it's critical, even for small towns, to take climate change seriously because it's increasingly becoming something they have to deal with.
Arguably, it's one of the number one concerns of municipalities, big or small, and it's a direction that we should all be moving in. It's really, really important for our children, our children's children, for future generations, that we do whatever we can to address this issue.
She says the village is now working to draft a climate action plan with a focus on sustainable transportation and energy-efficient buildings. As the COP26 climate conference ended, the U.S. branch of the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives released research on realistic pathways local governments can take to reduce per capita emissions by 63% or more by 2030 in order to meet Paris Climate Agreement goals. Angie Fife with the council says one way is through what's known as community choice aggregation, which allows governments to have a say in their local energy supplier.
That's a great way for a city to really lead by example and really demonstrate to the community that they're not only taking action themselves towards local environmental goals, but oftentimes these strategies will reduce the cost of operating city government.
She says Hastings-on-Hudson, which is powered by Sustainable Westchester, is among many New York towns that participate in community choice aggregation. I'm Emily Scott with New York News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Madam Speaker, pursuant to House Resolution 829, I call up the bill H.R. 6119 and ask for its immediate consideration in the House.
Connecticut Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro called the question as the House voted to fund the government through February 18th to avert a Friday government shutdown. Only one Republican, Illinois Representative Adam Kinzinger, supported the bill, which now heads to the Senate. The Omicron variant has been detected in a vaccinated Minnesota resident, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
The person's symptoms have resolved. The person spoke with the Minnesota Public Health Department investigators and reported traveling to New York City and attending the Anime New York City 2021 convention at the Javits Center.
The Minnesota case comes one day after the CDC confirmed the United States' first known case of the variant. Vice President Kamala Harris's chief spokesperson and senior advisor, Simone Sanders, has announced her departure from the administration, the second exit among Harris's communications staff in recent weeks. In North Carolina Thursday, Harris praised the state's Democratic lawmakers for their help passing the infrastructure law.
Because of their work, because of our work together, America is moving again. Because ultimately, that's what infrastructure is all about, getting people moving.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke about the importance of federal abortion care protections a day after all six conservative Supreme Court justices indicated they would uphold Mississippi's current law, banning abortion after 15 weeks.
Codification of Roe is the strongest weapon that we have to blunt these restrictive anti-woman state laws. Now, we don't know what the decision will be from the court.
The court is expected to issue a decision in June. The Department of Homeland Security says it's preparing to revive the Migrant Protection Protocols policy, more commonly known as the Remain in Mexico policy, which requires many migrants seeking asylum to stay in Mexico while awaiting immigration hearings. The Biden administration has tried multiple times to strike down the policy, but in August, a federal judge in Texas ordered the program restored. Finally, President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden lit the national Christmas tree in the south lawn of the White House Thursday evening, continuing a tradition begun in 1923.
For the evergreen tree reminds us that even in the coldest, darkest days of winter, that life and abundance will return. It's a bright beacon of hope that reminds us of the promise we find in Scripture.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
AINC programming is brought to you by WannaBrands, enhancing customers' lives through the responsible use of cannabis.